So when he figured out that he could finally make cars run on this stuff after messing with them, he was able to sell it really cheap because it was an industrial toxic waste byproduct. So in the cities, you would be able to buy gasoline at the pump, but once you got outside of the cities and you got into the countryside, you bought alcohol from farmers because virtually every farm had a still. Anybody here ever read Botany of Desire? A few people, good. Well, what, for those who don't haven't read that, a lot of the people who moved out west, started getting out past the confines of the East Coast, were God-fearing people, and the Bible did say, you know, thou shalt not drink the beverage of the grape, but never said anything about apples. So so every little farm had an apple orchard full of spitters, the kind of apples where you take a bite and you go, oh, boy, because they just were too tart, too bitter, but they were fermentable into apple whiskey, basically. You ferment apple wine, then you make apple whiskey. And so people at Model A's could stop by a farm, dump a bunch of this in the tank, make a few adjustments, and drive home. Anybody here have a Model A? Any Model A owners in the crowd? Okay, you've got the same thing on your tractor, the Fordson tractor. Well, the Model A had a knob on the dash, which people inaccurately called the choke, and that was the fuel air mixture knob. And you turn that a couple of turns, and that would adjust for alcohol versus gasoline, because alcohol needed less air than gasoline to run. And then the Model A had a digital distributor to determine when the spark should fire. It took 5 digits to operate, and it was up on the column. And so you would advance the spark as the car went faster by hand, and you would do it more for alcohol than you would for gasoline. And that was the total conversion of alcohol to gasoline for the Model A. So Ford and Rockefeller were bitter enemies for most of that period. And I'm abbreviating this a lot because I want to get to some of the main points of the conference more than the whole history of alcohol fuel. But for quite a while, there was a rivalry between the two. And alcohol was basically winning in the countryside, and only the city people were using oil. And so Rockefeller decided to stop playing fair. So we found a bunch of little old ladies who'd been around since the 1800s called the Women's Christian Temperance Movement. And he funded them to the tune of $4 million. And they went out and proceeded to buy Congress and got, get this, a constitutional amendment passed against the production of alcohol. So basically, this took the alcohol off the market as a fuel and allowed petroleum to become enmeshed as our national fuel. It took 13 years to reverse that constitutional amendment. So this is the kind of hardball transnational, what we now call transnational capitalism, does. Rockefeller was unsuccessful in that strategy in other countries, although he tried it in over 20 countries. So we've been up against organized resistance for a long time. It goes back even before oil. It has to do with the moneyed elite versus the people who produce. When farmers in Pennsylvania, right after the Revolution, were being faced with an edict from the government that they didn't like, there was nearly a second revolution. And that had to do with the fact that there were bills that had to be paid from the Revolutionary War. I mean, it cost money to do war. We borrowed money, and we had to pay it back. And the first proposition was a property tax, because now everybody had property, which before the king owned, so that seemed to make sense. But the elite said, no, we have most of the property and we don't want to be taxed. Let's put the tax on alcohol, a sin tax, so to speak, to pay our Revolutionary War bills. Well, the farmers out there in, you know, way far away from the East Coast in Pennsylvania, because that's how it was really, that was a 2-week trip back then, said, well, we didn't fight this war and sweat and blood and die and all that just to get taxed by another bunch of rich guys, so we're not going to pay the tax. So Washington, President Washington, instituted the first draft in the United States, 20,000 men, not against a foreign enemy, sent them out to Pennsylvania, and they killed 200 farmers in putting down the producers of alcohol. It was called the Whiskey Rebellion. Now, you might vaguely remember this from your high school history. Well, of course, that didn't work, you know, as it has never worked. It just meant that the farmers couldn't make their alcohol out in the open anymore. They did it at night, by the light of the moon and became known as moonshiners. But there's an eerie parallel to today. It turned out that the president, or you might say any president, because we're going to see a parallel, went ahead and used the nation's army to suppress his personal business interests competition, because George Washington was the largest distiller in the United States at the time. So it's just a little creepy that way. Let's really talk about fuel. Alcohol has been around a long time. It is produced from plants primarily. Plants go ahead and take CO2 from the air. They add it to water by way of sunlight and photosynthesis, and you get a carbohydrate, carbos. So carbon dioxide, hydrogen, water, nothing from the soil, ends up in alcohol. So this is really quite interesting. You take the carbohydrate, whether it's sugar or starch, and nowadays we're up to being able to use cellulose as well, the plant fiber that is part of every living plant. And we break this down into sugar, we feed it to yeast, and then the yeast do an imitation of humanity. They go ahead and eat everything inside till they pollute themselves to death and choke in their own waste. Okay? So that gets up around 12 or 13% alcohol, and then it's distilled and brought up to either pure alcohol, 200 proof, or with a couple of processes, or simply 193 proof. But that'll run a car just fine, alcohol at that level. So basically, that's just the simple process. Now, I bring it up because when you go ahead and burn it in a car, what comes out the exhaust pipe is pretty much what you would expect, CO2 and water. And the energy, the solar energy that tied all that together, is the explosion in your piston. So you're going down the street on liquid solar energy. Now, although the planet is, in theory, or I should say the universe in theory, is a closed energy system, the way we operate planet Earth is really operated more as an open energy system. Because at least for the next 4 or 5 billion years, we've got a daily income of energy from the sun. After that, we're kind of screwed. But for the next 4 or 5 billion years, we have an open system. So we can make alcohol from plants, and it works pretty well. The technology is, well, it's mankind's second oldest profession. It's pretty well known, and we've gotten it pretty down. Since the 80s, when this movement really got started, and when I was first involved in it, at that time, the equipment to make alcohol fuel was about $2.50 per gallon of annual production, and it cost about $2.50 to make. It was very expensive compared to gasoline. Due to some really modest subsidies and 20 years of people really working on it, it now costs about 90 cents a gallon to make a gallon of alcohol. And you can make, you can build the plants for about $1 a gallon. So subsidies really worked with the alcohol industry. It really created something that is now practical. So when we talk about some of the, can we solve these problems? Well, there's many levels to the problem. Money is not one of them. Money is not one of them. We're using right now about 160 billion gallons of gasoline a year, all right? Now, I just told you it costs about $1 per gallon to build plants that per gallon of annual capacity. So let's say we need 160 billion to build enough plants to fuel our cars. And I'm not saying we should be burning this much. We should be burning less than half this much. I'll explain how we can get there with alcohol. Well, if we added to that another $40 billion, to put alternative distribution in, because we can't expect the oil companies to willingly distribute the alcohol, we come up with about $200 billion, which is awfully close to what we've just spent in Iraq. Permanently solving the problem. Okay, so when it comes to doing an alternative solution that we can afford, this is one of the few. Hydrogen fuel cells, as we call them, is really a Trojan horse in which you find coal and nuclear hiding inside. So that's, you know, people are beginning to realize that, and there's no magic hydrogen that's going to save us. It's going to have to be something else. Curiously enough, alcohol is a bridge to a hydrogen future. A new low-cost catalyst was developed this year, which has no platinum in it, which can strip the hydrogen from alcohol and on board and run a hydrogen car at a much lower cost than almost any other way. So there is actually a renewable fuel that could be used, you know, to kind of get toward a hydrogen future, but it's really not all that necessary. The thing about internal combustion engines is that they're usually somewhere between 16 to 20% efficient. And there's some exceptions to that, of course. But what that means is, well, let's say you're Martians. Let's say you're all Martians and you're looking at an internal combustion engine. Well, in goes the fuel, so that's 100% of the energy. And let's say out this way goes 65% of the fuel through the radiator as heat. All right. And then down here, there might be another 10 to 15% in the oil, which is friction or heat. And then out the back here, you get, you know, something like 10 to 25% of a spinning shaft. And these numbers don't all add up perfectly. But the idea is, if you were a Martian looking at this machine, what would you say this machine does? It's a pretty good heater. And you get a little byproduct of mechanical energy, okay, you know, to run your car down the road. Now, I bring this up because it gets into what the qualities of alcohol fuel are. And in fact, I'd like to go ahead and ask you to list off some of the myths or things you've heard about alcohol fuel, and you'll see how we'll cut through most of those with just what we've talked about so far. So what are some of the myths about alcohol fuel or facts about alcohol fuel you think you've heard? So it's subsidized. Energy balance. Takes more land. Promotes monoculture. Monoculture and GMOs, okay? Oh, yes, the food versus fuel argument. I'll just put emissions. I'll cover them all. It's corrosive. Anything else? I can't wait to go to the bar with you. What was the other thing? Okay, that's an interesting question. Okay, and this is going to be just about enough. Damage and replace types of engines. Energy density. Okay, I think we can get all of this covered plus a little more. What's that? Water. Well, it does. I mean, if you have it, you know. But the fact that we're going to be talking about this as a viable alternative to oil does not excuse us from using as much as we're using now. Just keep remembering that. All right, let's talk about the subsidies things first. Pretty much, if you take a look at oil, some of the timid evaluations of how much oil is subsidized show it to be subsidized at the rate of about $5 per gallon. The more complete analysis of subsidies for oil show it to be subsidized at about $15 per gallon. Alcohol right now is subsidized at about 50 cents a gallon. So I'd say on the subsidy ballpark, we have a very unequal playing field in favor of oil. Last year, oil companies got a grant of $77 million to go ahead, this is a grant, they don't have to pay this back from Homeland Security, to beef up security against terrorism at their refineries, as if they needed more money, which was only slightly less than the entire renewable energy budget of the DOE. You're talking about a system in which every gallon of oil you take out of the ground are public oil that theoretically we own and we lease for them to take out of the ground, that they get an oil depletion allowance and get tax relief by depleting the resource. So, you know, let's not talk about subsidies unless we're willing to talk about getting rid of all the subsidies. Let's move. I'm going to try to move to some of the smaller ones first and get to some of the bigger ones where we can get some discussion going. Okay, let's see. Makes you blind. That's subjective. The objective part of it is that methanol, which is a very different alcohol, it's one carbon alcohol instead of two, will make you blind, actually destroys the retina. That's because of what happens when it hits your liver. And alcohol, when it hits your liver, becomes acetaldehyde, and that's what gets you drunk. But when wood alcohol or methanol hits your liver, it turns into a different aldehyde, formaldehyde, which literally pickles your liver and your eyes and everything else. So ethanol doesn't do this. Okay. Methanol? Methanol, if you rub it on your skin, can do that to you. It can soak into your skin. It's really toxic stuff. And the coal companies are really pushing methanol as a future fuel. It also puts out a pollutant called methyl nitrite, which at only 250 parts per million is fatal. So methanol and ethanol are two very different things when it comes to using them as fuels. Okay. We'll get there. Alcohol has a lot of other good qualities, which get into some of these kinds of questions. Alcohol, there's questions about hurting the car, damage to the car. Right now, there's a whole campaign that's going on in Australia to try to stop alcohol from entering the market. It's exactly the same campaign that was done here 25 years ago. They're saying it'll destroy all the rubber parts, it'll cause corrosion in all the metal, you don't want it in your car at all, etc. Turns out that alcohol doesn't do any of those things except for rubber that was made back before 1983 and then only on certain rubbers. It burns so clean, actually, in your engine that the inside of your engine gets no carbon buildup whatsoever. And carbon buildup in your engine is like microscopic sandpaper, which is what wears out an engine. Test after test, decade after decade, alcohol-fueled engines repeatedly show that they last three times as long as a gasoline engine. Now, those of you who've looked at embodied energy can see that, the amount of energy that goes into making it an engine is an enormous quantity, not to mention the water and everything else. Cutting down the number of engines we have to produce is one reason alone to run alcohol. It's such a clean fuel. Now, it's so clean, produces so little carbon, that has some implications for the environment as well. I'm right now trying to get some more modern statistics on this, which is very difficult because since the 80s, the last big boom of interest in alcohol, there's been very little corporate money put into studying pure alcohols as a fuel. At the time, what we were studying, the EPA and also private people were finding that when we took a look at the emissions from alcohol, we were finding a 90%+ reduction in hydrocarbons. We were finding a 97% reduction in carbon monoxide and a 60 to 80% reduction in nitrous oxides. This stuff is pretty darn clean. Now, the percent reductions today will be less because cars today are not putting out quite as much as they did in the 80s. But, still, alcohol is going to be dramatically lower. So clean, in fact, I got a story to tell you. I worked with Gordon Cooper down in L.A. He was working on getting jet airplanes certified to use alcohol. Gordon Cooper, you may remember, was an astronaut and aerospace engineer. And we just got this brand new exhaust gas analyzer, and we were going to be testing alcohol in the turbine, and we fired it up, and we put the test probe in the back in the exhaust stream, and none of the needles are moving. And we're going, this thing's broken. We bought this big machine. It doesn't even work. Tap, tap, tap. It's not working. So he sets it down in front of the engine on the table, and the air going in to the turbine makes all the needles go up. The air coming in from LA going into the turbine was dirtier than the air coming out of the exhaust. So by burning alcohol, we actually cleaned the pollution up. Um, So that has big implications for your engine. One of the things that's really, the nitrous oxides being low is a really good indicator of temperature. What was that? Oh, I thought I heard a comment. You know, the engine damage. A lot of people say, oh, alcohol burns hot. It'll destroy your engine, you know. It actually burns about 300 degrees cooler than gasoline. Gasoline burns at about 1,400 degrees Fahrenheit. Alcohol burns at about 1,000. So what that means is less fuel energy is going to waste heat. So although it starts off with less energy, someone asked about energy density. Alcohol starts off with only 2/3 the energy density of gasoline. It burns with much higher efficiency. And in fact, I just read a paper, a 2002 paper that the EPA did, where they took a Volkswagen TDI diesel engine and used that as the base, and then they went ahead and put in different fuel injectors, reduced the compression ratio a little bit, and ran it on alcohol, and actually got 25% better miles per gallon on alcohol than they would have gotten on diesel, which is much more efficient than gasoline, with like almost no emissions. So that's, you know, that's the future of alcohol fuel engines. Our current engines that we have are typically going to lose somewhere between 5 to 8, sometimes 9% miles per gallon as they come from Detroit now, except if you have a flexible fuel vehicle. Now, how many people here have heard of flexible fuel vehicles? Well, this is a much better informed group. For 10 years now, you've been able to buy cars right from the dealers that are set up to run on alcohol or gasoline or a mixture of the two without your having to even think about it. You can put whatever you want in the tank, and yet you haven't heard about it, or very few of you have heard about it. I've got a Ford Ranger, for instance, that runs on it. So those are cars that have a smarter computer, that have a sensor telling the computer how much fuel is gasoline and how much is alcohol, and making the adjustments for air versus fuel the way that we used to do in the Model A with our hand and the knob. That, now we have to have a computer for that. So, and it works, yes. Right, and you can go ahead and you can crank up the pressure on the fuel regulator. There's little tricks you can do if you want to just convert it to run on one or the other. But we have cars now that can run on both, and you can buy them for the same price as you can on gasoline. Oh, no, sorry, that's not right. You get a $1,500 tax credit for buying the alcohol version. Let's see, energy density. Liquid fuels are really energy dense. There are now just about to come on the market replacements for the batteries that are on your laptops that you put in alcohol. There's a tiny fuel cell in it. Runs for 18 hours. Okay, so that's about to come on the market in the next year. So alcohol does make a really good fuel cell feedstock. So that's a micro use. Getting up to some of the big ones. Promotes monoculture or GMOs. That absolutely should not be true and won't be true in the long run. It'll start off that way. Right now, most of the alcohol in this country is made from corn, not because it's the best crop for making alcohol, but because we've got one hell of a lot of corn. And, you know, what do you do with it all? So I'll tell you what you do with it. 90% of it, I should say not 90% straight off. So we got that you start off with 70% of the corn gets fed directly to animals. 20% of the corn goes for exports. But guess what they feed with the corn? More animals. This goes to make other wealthy countries animals. So most of our corn goes for animal feed. Now, this food versus fuel argument and the monoculture thing, we're going to kind of blend them together. Because in permaculture, one of the things we always do is we go back to the source. So does anybody know the genetic origins, the place on Earth where cattle came from? Africa. Northern Africa and a little bit of Southern Europe. And what's in Northern Africa today? The Sahara Desert. But it was a forest at one time, and cattle lived in it. And cattle turn out to be forest-living creatures. They eat brush. They've got four stomachs, you know? I mean, we don't need four stomachs because we're not eating brush. And cattle are not prairie animals. They're not grass eaters. If you take one look at their foot, you can tell that they're not a prairie animal. They have a flat foot. That's good for soft forest soil. You need a cloven hoof like a bison if you want to be going through prairie turf, you know. So anyway, that's where cattle come from. That's what they ate, was brushy stuff. The Sahara, by the way, is a human-made desert by overgrazing. But that's a whole other story. We won't go there today. So here we are feeding cattle grass. I mean, but corn is grass, you know, and we feed them the seed of grass. It turns out cows do not have the enzymes to break down starch because they are not evolved to eat it. So it goes out 80% undigested. 70% of each kernel of corn is starch. So they feed the corn to the cattle for fat and protein. But what comes out the back is wasted starch. Now, when you go ahead and first ferment alcohol from corn, you take out the starch and you have what's left over called dried distiller's grains and solubles. Now, if you take this, and this has not only been fermented, now it has the yeast, you know, in with it. When you feed this to the animals, you know, 35 pounds of this instead of 100 pounds of corn, in other words, the equivalent amount of the corn you would have fed them, the cattle gain 17% more weight, 30% faster. So when you look at it, you got to turn the paradigm on its head. The fermentation of corn for alcohol, the alcohol is a byproduct of making higher quality animal feed and reducing the amount of land we need to raise cattle. So the food versus fuel argument is clearly propaganda. Now, Barry Commoner took a look at this when we looked at this in the 80s, and we figured out if we start incorporating cellulosic alcohol production, which is where we start taking woody materials, breaking those down to alcohol, and ferment them, et cetera, with yeast, and we did this as a national policy to replace all the gasoline, just the yeast alone recovered from the fermentation would replace all the grain grown in the United States for cattle feed, because yeast is 50% protein. So cellulosic alcohol will take a little more discussion, but the point is, as we start looking at these systems ecologically, there are many linkages that need to be looked at. Monoculture as part of this. This is gonna, if there's any one thing that's gonna break down the monoculture in the Midwest, it's gonna be alcohol fuel. Right now, you go to an alcohol fuel conference and it's corn farmers. And corn farmers, what can I say about this that's really polite? I mean, hey, I'm a farmer, so I can say these things, you know. I got up in front of 1,500 corn farmers and I said to them, you guys, this is an alcohol conference, I said, you guys are thinking about this whole thing like you're corn farmers. Now, there's all this, and I said, I'm from California, you know. I grow organic vegetables. I bring in $100,000 per acre on my permaculture farm. You guys are bringing in $50 an acre on your corn. So I think I have something to say here. You guys are selling a premium fuel, 105 octane, burns better than anything, it's clean, it's environmental, and there's a market of people out there that would love to put that in their car instead of gasoline, and you're selling it like it's corn. You need to sell it like it's organic figs. You got to sell it like it's worth something. So, you know, I planted that seed. And what's happening is, as half the alcohol in the country right now is made by farm cooperatives. It's not made by Archer Daniels Midland, not made by Cargill. It's made by farmers who've gotten together, plunged a bunch of money together, borrowed some more, and built 50 million gallon per year plants. At some point, they're going to realize, I'm not a corn farmer. I'm an energy farmer. And what might be better for me to make money on in my plant than the corn I'm growing? And it turns out, almost anything. So depending on the climate you're in, you have many choices about what alternative crops would be. For instance, beets. You get this far north, sugar beets or fodder beets, which get about this big. You can get 1,400 gallons of alcohol per acre and more protein for animal feed than you would get from the grain. There's a bunch of other crops, Jerusalem artichokes, etc. What you would start to see in a national alcohol fuel program is polyculture, which is what we all go for in permaculture. And you can start to see multiple things happening in one field as we get into cellulose, too. I recently filed a patent related to alcohol fuel that should put Monsanto in its grave. And I first announced it at Champaign-Urbana University, right next door to the Monsanto room. So all the guys who came from the college were sitting out. I said, I hope you all have your resume sharpened up because I'm about to put you all out of work. So here's how it works. The reason why I'm going to explain this to you is it explains to you how agriculture works, and why we need to look at the whole system like permaculture so when we solve these problems. If you ask the USDA, what is agriculture? They have a very straightforward answer. It's corn, it's soybeans, and it's specialty crops. Anything else other than corn and soybeans is in the specialty crops category, like beneath their notice, okay? So you're taking a look at a corn farmer, and he's growing an acre of corn, and I already mentioned to you he makes $50. Now, that's his net, but he takes in $200 to start with. So about $100 is fertilizer. Now, I want you to pay attention to this fertilizer part because it's going to have a lot of impact on this energy balance question. And about $40 of it is herbicide for that fancy GMO corn. About $10 of it is the corn seed, okay? The extra price they're paying for GMO seed. So out of that $200, $150 is all this stuff, and he gets maybe $40 or $50 at the end. Now, we take the corn in this case. We ferment it. We make the alcohol by taking the starch out. What part of the soil was in the starch? None. So that means that everything that was in the soil is where? In the DDGS, in the dried distiller's grains that's left over. So we first get alcohol. We also, by the way, got CO2 because carbon dioxide is given off during fermentation. We collect that and sell it. We also get the dried distiller's grains. Now, instead of feeding the dried distiller's grains to the cattle, you put it back in the ground. And as my study showed, that we took an average field in Nebraska, 160 bushel per acre corn field. We took that 160 bushels, made alcohol with it, took that amount of dried distiller's grains, figured out how much fertilizer value was in that dried distiller's grains, and it was 10% more than was needed to grow the next 160 bushels. That has to do with mycorrhizal fungi bringing in more nutrients to the plant than were put on it. So here's a system in which the farmer now no longer needs fertilizer. No longer, I forgot to tell you, the reason why I'm doing this is how many people have ever heard of corn gluten meal? Okay, so corn gluten meal is a protein in corn that's sometimes sold to organic gardeners to do what? Kill weeds. In other words, corn gluten meal will stop weed seeds from sprouting. No one knows why, although I do now. And I started this experiment because dried distiller's grains was a lot cheaper than corn gluten meal, and I wanted to see if it would do the same thing, and it does. So the dried distiller's grains is a pre-emergent herbicide. In other words, it stops weed seeds from sprouting. As soon as they sprout, they die. That's because what I've done by putting this stuff in the soil is I've fed seed-eating fungi and bacteria. There's a population explosion, so when the weed seeds sprout, that exploding biology eats the little roots of the weed seeds. It's really a tricky little system, really fun. So the farmer doesn't need to buy the Roundup anymore because he's got it built in, and he doesn't need to buy the GMO corn. So now, instead of making $40 on a crop. He's got some cost for the dried distiller's grains. He might make now $130. And I'm telling you, if you tell a farmer, would you rather make $130 doing this hippie patented process, or do you want to make $40 and have Monsanto fleece you? They'll go, where's that hippie? Where can I talk to him? Okay? Because money talks. So I'm in the middle of trying to, the reason why I patented this, I'm really usually against patents, but I'm like this little and Monsanto's like that big. So I'm trying to get this license off to a big enough corporation so they can battle it out. But this alone, this process of alcohol alone is worth doing it for, just to wipe out Monsanto, because 70% of Monsanto's business is Roundup and Roundup Ready seed for corn. Now, that brings us over here to the energy balance thing. Energy balance has been a masterful piece of PR deception by the oil companies for over 40 years. What the proposition is it takes more energy to produce alcohol than you get out of it. And the first studies that said this pre-1980 were based on beverage distilleries that were from the 1940s that didn't care anything about the price of energy because they were making whiskey, you know, and the price of energy was immaterial to the profit from the whiskey. Well, when that cover got blown and the scientists debunked all that, the oil companies came up with a clever way of keeping the argument going. They found the perfect whitewash man in a scientist named David Pimentel. Now, David Pimentel, you know, in many fields, is a person I would respect. The guy's an organic bug scientist. In fact, he's the only organic bug scientist I know who's never had a funding problem. And it turned out that he and four other guys together wrote a study in 1982 that said that it takes more energy to make alcohol from corn than you get out of it. The only problem, David Pimentel was working for Mobil Oil and was being paid for them when he did that study. Jack Anderson outed that in the public. Mobil Oil was so arrogant that they came out and took out a full-page ad out saying, how dare you impugn the credibility of such a man like David Pimentel simply because he was taking money from us. It's like, well, duh, yeah, exactly, you know. So okay. So that's just like global warming. You know, whenever there's an article in the paper about global warming, they bring one of the six scientists left in the world that says global warming's a theory to be balanced, to be the opposite statement for the 6,000 that say it's a fact. Pimentel is that one for alcohol. And whenever he speaks, the American Petroleum Institute sends out 10,000 press releases. So let's talk a little more about exactly what's wrong with his study and what the reality is. He gives no value whatsoever, energy-wise, to the dried distiller's grains in the process. He gives all the value to the fertilizer, which is the biggest part, the herbicide, and he does a lot of good, responsible ecological accounting of the amount of energy it takes to make the steel for the tractor to run. I mean, this is good energy accounting when you're trying to get an accurate idea of if a system's really positive or not. But he leaves out the fact that running that tractor on alcohol means that you only need one-third as many tractors, or that all the cars running on the fuel need one-third as many engines, and all that embodied energy doesn't go into his study. He also leaves out the CO2 as a product that which should get an energy credit. Now, a lot of you guys are thinking out there, now, wait a minute, CO2 doesn't burn. CO2 is what's after things are burned. How is that an energy source? Do you know how they make the CO2 for all your sodas? Anybody know? They burn natural gas and throw away the heat. Because natural gas is one carbon and four hydrogens. They go ahead and burn it. They get CO2 and then two water molecules. So all the fermentation CO2 displaces the natural gas CO2 that's being thrown away. Well, these are the things he conveniently, some of the numerous things he conveniently leaves out of his study, and well-meaning people quote Pimentel right and left, not realizing that he's really cherry-picked the data and is basically, there are nicer words for it, and I can't think of them right now, but So anyway, the energy balance thing is bogus. The current best data, when you do include the energy balance just for the DDGS and not for the CO2 and not for any of this other stuff, is a 2.94-to-1 return. And I'll get a copy of that for you, Richard. I know you'll be interested in that. And when you get to other crops like cassava and sugarcane, the return is 5.6 and 11.2-to-1. In the case of sugarcane, no petroleum is used in the process. The sugarcane bagasse, or the fiber left over, is burned for making electricity and heat to run the plant, and actually has a surplus amount of electricity to put back into the grid. So it's actually higher than 11.2-to-1. They don't count the electricity they sell into the grid into the equation. So, you know, we have ways of producing it, capturing solar energy in efficient ways that allow us to have an energy positive fuel for our cars. Okay, so that's the energy balance thing. Won't promote monocrops because there's so many things you can grow. For instance, there's all kinds of, how much time do I have? It's like crops like pimelons. 10 minutes. Okay, I'm going to say just a few more things, and then I'm going to let you ask some more questions. Food versus fuel, we got emissions. CO2, I'm going to do that. Corrosion, not an issue, doesn't corrode anything. Let's see. CO2, okay. The oil companies say 20 pounds of CO2 comes out the tailpipe of an alcohol vehicle, just like a gasoline vehicle, for every gallon. And then you get people who are, you know, botanists who say, well, that's silly, because the 20 pounds that came out of the car go back into the plant, you know, and that makes next year's crop, so you really have a net zero CO2, you know, production, because it's constantly in cycle. But permaculturists go a little further, because we look underground. And 50% of almost any plant is underground, and all of this plant matter is made of carbon. You know, this half of the plant is carbon. There's just, when you look at these trees outside, there's just as much tree below ground as there is above ground. So now you're looking at actually quite a bit more carbon than, you know, is recycled than was used by the car. Then you start looking a little further about how plants really work, because most of us have been taught that the flow of energy in a plant is this way, that nutrients are pulled out of the ground and they go up into the plant, and like it's all a one-way trip and there's no mutualism. It's not that way at all. Oxygen and CO2 are pumped down in through the plant and out into the soil around the roots, where it feeds anaerobic and aerobic bacteria. 60% of the carbon produced by photosynthesis, in other words, sugar, is pumped out of the roots into the soil to feed bacteria and this whole microlife that is around the root zone. So now you're looking at something like 10 times the CO2 is impounded for every one unit that goes into fuel. Now, some of this will recycle eventually back into the air slowly, and some will stay tied up in this biomass. So it doesn't stay at this level, but it buffers quite a bit. Okay, I'm going to tell you a quick story, and then I'll take a couple of questions with the time I have left. I did this book on this subject in 1982. I finished, the book was called Alcohol Can Be a Gas, and I had taught 8,000 people around the country how to make alcohol in a couple of years in workshops. And PBS came to me and said, you know, Channel 9 in San Francisco, KQED, came and said, we want you to do this for public television. And we said, all right, revolution on TV. So we did 10 half-hour shows. We filmed the whole process of making alcohol fuel. This is a how-to show, right? Not, wouldn't it be nice if we had an alcohol fuel economy? When we went 1,500 miles and filmed my students at their stills that they had built making alcohol and people doing car conversions and the whole thing, wrote a whole book on the subject so that people could go ahead and do it themselves to go along with the series. I was at the printer in Oregon. It was like we were running a little behind on getting the book printed. The fourth segment of the series had just aired in San Francisco. And the call comes up to the publisher. stop the presses, send the check back. And I go, what's going on? What's going on? They won't talk to me. After a couple of weeks of hammering at them, they finally will meet with me and talk with me. They took the advertisement for the book tag off the end of the series and let the series finish airing, because that would have been too embarrassing to explain how it had been, why it had been stopped. But they wouldn't release it to the rest of the network, and they wouldn't print the book. And it turns out they got a call from Chevron that was went along the lines of, what's wrong? You don't like our money? And canceled the project. So that was in 1983. If that book would have been on the air in 83, and it talked all about peak oil. Peak oil is nothing new. General Motors had papers about peak oil it was giving the government in 1982. I mean, we've known this on the inside. The scientific community has known about Hubbard and right around 2000 and all that for a long time. But if this series had been on the air when it was supposed to have been in 83, we wouldn't have even been in Iraq the first time, much less this time, because at least half the country would have been running on alcohol by now. You think that's too far-fetched? 40% of the cars in Brazil run on alcohol right now. They import no oil whatsoever, and they've got 100 million barrels a day they have to get rid of because it's toxic waste they have no use for. Today, it's the same thing. When they go to refine oil, they make thousands of dollars from a barrel of oil on chemicals and products, and then $100, $200 on gasoline, because it's the dumping ground of all the other processes. Gasoline never has the same formula 2 days in a row. It's whatever is left over from the runs at the refinery, and then they get us to buy it to dispose of it for them in the air. So that's what gasoline is. It's the waste disposal process for the oil industry. So anyway, wrap this up. Basically, where we're at now is the book is 3 or 4 months from being finished to go to New Society Press, and they're going to be publishing it. We are still trying to pull a little bit more money together. We have a few more places to visit. We just made breakthroughs in being able to visit Brazil and bring a camera team and stuff. So this project has not been, we've did this in a very permaculture way. We went to people and got loans, you know, investors to do this project. So we weren't, you know, under one foundation's thumb that could have this, you know, could pull the string on us just like happened to us before. So we've got about 15 investors, and we need a few more to finish the project. So if anybody wants to talk with me about that, I'm going to be around. And let's see. Our website is permaculture.com. Our alter ego is we teach permaculture courses around the world. And the whole alcohol information is on our site as well. And any last quick questions before I get cut off here?
I'm interested in the energy balance. The energy balance thing. Could you talk a little bit about the fuel that you recommend for heating the mash?
I used to use wood. I used to use waste wood.
But
I also use donut fat.
On a large scale.
Did everybody hear the question? What was my heating source for the still?
But in a vision for the whole country in a large scale, what do you?
Yeah, sure.
What do you see? Are you still using petroleum for that?
It depends on your feedstock for heating. Right. If you have anything that's fibrous, then plant fiber is your best fuel because it's renewable, it's solar-based. But when I used to collect donuts, I used to do this in San Francisco, so we'd get donuts, you know. I mean, cops can only eat so many. And then they got to throw them away. So we'd take home these drums of donuts, and we would go ahead and cook them down. And, of course, what are donuts made of? Fat, starch, and sugar. There's 10 teaspoons of sugar in every donut, in addition to the starch. So when you cook up the donuts, the fat floats. We would skim that off, and I guess we could have made biodiesel with it, but we used it to fire the still because it was like 150,000 BTUs per pound in the donut fat. So that was really a nice integrated raw material from the city, you know.
I'm just curious, with the economics that you shouted out or talked about, the $200 million, from a venture fund point of view, that's a nothing investment.
Right. Absolutely.
Why doesn't the economics itself, when you can, let's say,
invest $200 million to produce a gallon of fuel for a dollar, that's now selling almost close to $3.
Well, and then wholesale $1.70.
Okay, but anyway, why wouldn't the normal business economics just have venture people fund this thing if it all played out the way you discussed it?
That's because the margin just got that wide in the last year. The margin between the wholesale production price and the sale price was only 10 cents until oil shot up. And now they're getting a good margin. And so now it's the kind of thing like a venture capitalist or a banker, an investment house would say, fine. But, you know, there'll be a while before they're going to want to see if it'll go up and down before venture people will come in. But right now, alcohol plants are not having trouble getting financing. It's a mature technology.
And it started here in Ohio. There's a plant online in Medina that uses waste soda pop, and another one planned for online in Akron that will produce 400,000 gallons a day from waste paper.
I want to know about that one, because the new cellulose ones are the ones I want to know about.
Yeah, I was wondering how you say Brazil is producing, is 40% of their vehicles are running on alcohol.
Straight alcohol.
How are they doing that, and why is it that, I'm just curious as to who's involved financially and why the major oil companies, if they're not getting a piece of that, are allowing that to happen.
So in Brazil, up until 20 years ago, it was a military dictatorship. And that's when they started the program. Because when the first oil shocks happened in the 70s, Brazil had only recently stopped using alcohol. You got to realize that prior to World War II, lots of countries that were not on tanker routes were using alcohol. Philippines, you know, New Zealand. No way, nobody was delivering oil there. And nobody was delivering oil to Brazil. It was making its own alcohol. So they'd only briefly been on alcohol for about 20 years, or 30 years, when the big oil shocks hit in 73. And the military said, well, we know how to do this. We're going back to that. And so that's where it started. And then Brazil democratized, and it has it got to one point where almost 90% of the cars were running on alcohol. Then in the middle of the 90s, the price dove for the price of oil down to $10 a barrel briefly. A bunch of cars got converted back. And now alcohol is half the price of gasoline in Brazil, and everybody's converting back to alcohol. So, you know, it's been like that.
When you were talking about the sustainability of alcohol production, you suggested using the DDGs for fertilizer.
Right.
But when it seems to conflict with the food fuel land argument, because there you were going to feed it to animals. How do you resolve the conflict? And if I could throw in a second one, what about the food chain argument about animal feed versus using it as direct food, you know, using the vegetable rather than animal as food?
Well, as I said a little bit earlier, just the yeast collected alone from a national alcohol fuel program would replace all the grain. Because remember, it's only protein and fat we get from grain for the animals. So we'd get all that back from the distillery, instead of the dried distiller's grains. So we wouldn't really lose animal feed there at all. There's a whole argument to be made that part of the reduction that we need to make, you know, in a post-oil world is cutting way back on meat, because meat is extremely energy intensive for a lot of reasons. And it takes 10 or 11 BTUs of energy, food energy, not even fossil fuel energy, to produce to make a pound of beef. It only takes 3 BTUs to make a chicken. It only takes 2 BTUs to make a pound of fish. So, you know, you start looking at what's better to grow. So you got Archer Daniels Midland, right? You know, the definition of corporate evil. With 5 acres of tilapia ponds that they're growing tilapia using DDGS, and they're delivering and part of the year that means it's organic, because they have 3 months a year where they run nothing but organic through their plant for Europe. And then they go ahead and deliver live tilapia in tank trucks running on biodiesel to restaurants all over the East. So if a big corporation can do it like that, why can't you do it? Because everything they did was in multiple units of small units. Anything that was there could have been a small farm doing it. You know, there was, and that's what will be in our book, is this kind of integrated approach. You know.
Yeah, real simple math here. how much alcohol do you get per acre, per crop, whatever your best crop, whether it's sugar beets or corn or whatever?
Well, this is a really curious question. What's the best yield per acre? I just did a calculation yesterday that I had to triple check. In Arcata, California, they process the municipal sewage with cattails. You know, they put the secondary sewage in through long canals that they grow cattails in, and all the nutrients are sucked out and into the cattails. Now, we were really thrilled because the base of the cattails is almost pure starch, and Indians in this country used to make bread from that. So we were really looking at that as our primary yield, as the starchy roots, and we were getting 2,000 gallons per acre. But then we started looking at 50 tons of dry cellulose above, and if we use Rocky Mountain Institute's numbers, that would be 9,000 more gallons of alcohol. So you got 9,000, 11,000 gallons of alcohol per acre from our sewage. You know, and we all have sewage. So that's like the stratosphere of it. You know, most well-managed, and in this is the other thing about permaculture, is we do multiple cropping. We do things that work together. So, you know, when you see these figures like 1,300 gallons per acre for beets or 1,800 gallons per acre for sugarcane, in permaculture, we typically plant three or four or five things together that all have different canopy heights and different characteristics. And if we can harvest all of that, you know, and make alcohol from it, we're going to get more per acre. We're just right on the very fringe of the frontier of studying how permaculture can make this thing go forward. I did a calculation the other day, for instance, that you know about the dead zones in the, okay, it's all the nitrates running down river. It does a good thing, right? It makes all the bacteria in the Gulf grow. Oh, well, that's cool. Not bacteria, but algae. But then it dies. And as it dies, the bacteria start to eat the algae, and they need air, so they use all the air up in the water. So for 22,000 square kilometers at the base of the Mississippi, there's no air for any animals to live, and they all die. So we took calculations from how the Chinese grow kelp at the mouths of rivers where there's usually sewage, you know, in case of China, and we applied it to this dead zone, and we came up with being able to supply about 18% of the country's fuel and returning oxygen to the water in this dead zone. I mean, when you start looking at whole systems in permaculture, you can come up with places where you take surpluses that are not being used and make them into useful stuff. Now, it's not the best way. The best way is to stop the nitrates way upstream. But as an interim strategy, kelp farming out there could be incredibly profitable, you know. So, I mean, it goes on and on. We can do so much with this. And I'm happy to talk with you during the breaks. That was the last question. And again, if you need to write to us, learn more about it, or talk with me about investments in the book, permaculture.com is the best place to reach me.
David Bloom, speaking at the First National Conference on Peak Oil and Community Solutions, November 12th through 14th in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Thanks to Peter Arena, Megan Quinn, Faith Morgan, and Pat Murphy for their assistance. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. If you'd like to find out more about the program or communicate about any of the material you've heard, you can write to me directly at lynn@ithacaradio.org, lyn@ithacaradio.org. Thanks for listening. Always be filled by